Mandatory opening narration. Welcome to Ekatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI.
Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're diving deep, really deep, into a book many of us probably read as children, but maybe haven't revisited with, let's say, adult eyes. Kenneth Graham's The Wind in the Willows.
It's one of those books, isn't it? Seems simple on the surface, talking animals, boats, picnics, but wow, there's so much more going on underneath.
Exactly. And the first thing that always strikes me is the author himself, Kenneth Graham. You picture maybe a whimsical academic, perhaps?
You might think so, but no, he was the Secretary of the Bank of England, a very serious, high-powered job in finance.
Right. Talk about contrast.
Yeah.
This man dealing with, you know, money and commerce day in, day out, creates this incredibly gentle, pastoral world.
It's fascinating. And his own life story, well, it really feeds into the book's feeling, I think.
Definitely. He had a tough childhood. His mother died when he was only five. His father struggled with alcoholism. So he ended up living with his grandmother in Berkshire. And that countryside, the River Thames nearby, that became his escape, didn't it?
Absolutely. It feels like that landscape is baked into the very soul of the book. It's not just a setting. It's almost a character itself, a place of safety.
And the reason he started writing it, it wasn't for publication initially, was it?
No, not at all. It actually began as bedtime stories.
Yeah.
Stories and then letters he wrote for his son, Alistair.
Mouse, he called him.
Yeah, Mouse. Alistair was apparently quite a fragile child, visually impaired, and it feels like Graham was crafting this perfect, safe, beautiful world just for him, almost like a protective spell.
That adds such a layer of tenderness to it all. So when it finally gets published, 1908, what's happening in the world then?
What's the Edwardian era? Britain's sort of caught between, you know, the old Victorian ways and this rush towards modernity industry.
Yeah.
The motor car is just starting to appear.
Ah, the motor car. We'll definitely come back to that.
Oh, yes. So the book lands in this period of change, and it feels very much like a deliberate look backwards, doesn't it? A real nostalgia for a quieter, maybe simpler, pre-industrial England.
Like an idealized escape.
Exactly. And the initial reaction, well, critics were a bit baffled, apparently.
How so?
They called it things like an odd hybrid creation. Wasn't quite a children's fable, wasn't quite an adult novel. It sort of fell between the cracks for them.
But the public got it.
The public loved it.
Yeah.
And some influential figures, too, like Teddy Roosevelt over in America was a huge fan. It just resonated.
So what's our goal today? What should we try and unpack for everyone listening?
I think we need to get to the heart of that central tension Graham sets up. It's all about balance, isn't it? The pull between staying safe at home, you know, the comfort of the known.
Right, the riverbank.
Versus that call of adventure, the excitement, maybe the danger of the unknown world beyond. Home versus the open road.
Okay, let's jump right in then. Where does it all begin?
It starts with Mole. Our way into this world. He's busy spring cleaning his little underground home.
A very relatable feeling, the drudgery of chores.
Totally. And then suddenly, he's hit by what Graham calls spring fever, an irresistible urge.
He just drops everything.
Completely. Burrows his way up into the sunlight, and bam, he discovers the river. And importantly, he meets Rat.
Water Rat, or Ratty. And that's the catalyst, isn't it? Meeting Rat opens up this whole new community, this whole new way of life.
It really does. And the setting itself is key. It's this beautiful English countryside. But the animals, well, they talk, they wear clothes sometimes, they behave like Edwardian gentlemen.
Anthropomorphic, but in a very specific, mannered way.
Precisely. So the big question Graham poses right away is how these different personalities, these characters, embody the different ways of living, the different choices you can make.
Let's look at the main four then. We start with Mole. Who is he, essentially?
Mole is the newcomer. He's a bit timid, maybe naive at first, but he's full of curiosity. He represents, I think, the reader stepping into this world, wanting to learn, wanting to belong, seeking growth.
Okay. And then there's Ratty.
Ah, Ratty. He's the heart of the riverbank, really.
Yeah.
Content, kind, bit of a poet. He loves his river, loves his boat. He's the anchor.
He embodies that philosophy of simple contentment.
Perfectly. And he has that wonderful line early on, trying to explain the river life to Mole.
Oh, the messing about in boats line. It's iconic.
It is. He says, Believe me, my young friend, there is nothing, absolutely nothing, half so much worth doing as simply messing about in boats.
And it's not just about boats, is it? It's about finding joy in the simple present moment.
Exactly. It's the whole philosophy of life packed into one sentence. Very anti-striving, you know?
Right. And then the complete opposite, Mr. Toad.
Laugh slightly. Oh, Toad! Where to begin? He's the chaos agent.
Definitely. Rich, charming in his own way, but so incredibly vain, boastful, impulsive doesn't even cover it.
No. He represents unchecked desire, I suppose. Adventure without limits, without responsibility. He drives so much of the actual plot, the conflict.
He certainly does. And rounding out the quartet.
Badger. The wise old hermit figure. He lives in the wild wood. Keeps himself to himself, mostly.
He feels ancient somehow.
He does. He represents tradition, stability, authority, when it's needed. He's the grown-up, the one who steps in when things get really out of hand, like with Toad.
Which brings us neatly to Toad's, his downward spiral. The adventure part of the book really kicks off with him, doesn't it?
It does. He gets obsessed with things. First, it's a horse-drawn caravan. He buys the best one, convinces Rat and Molly to go on a trip.
Which sounds quite idyllic, initially.
For about 5 minutes. Then, roaring down the road, comes a motor car. Scares the horse. The caravan ends up in a ditch, completely wrecked.
And Toad's reaction? Is he upset about his expensive caravan?
Not remotely. The second he sees that motor car, hears the engine. Poof. The caravan is forgotten. He is instantly, utterly obsessed with cars.
That's the intrusion of modernity you mentioned.
Yeah.
Loud, fast, destructive.
And utterly seductive, at least for Toad. He has to have one. Then another. He drives recklessly, crashes them constantly. His friends try to intervene.
Rat, Mole, and eventually Badger, they try a sort of intervention.
Yeah, they try reasoning with him. Then they basically put him under house arrest in Toad Hall to stop him driving.
Which lasts about as long as the caravan obsession.
Pretty much. He fakes illness, tricks the ever-loyal Ratty, and escapes. Steals a car. Gets caught, inevitably. And the trial scene is just peak Toad. Utterly arrogant. Totally unrepentant.
And the sentence reflects that.
20 years. In a grim, dark dungeon. It's the classic story of hubris, isn't it? Pride comes before a fall, quite literally into prison.
While all that drama with Toad is unfolding, though, Graham doesn't forget the others. Mole, in particular, is still growing.
Yes, absolutely. There's that really important section where Mole, feeling a bit adventurous himself, ventures into the wildwood alone in winter.
Which is depicted as genuinely scary, isn't it? Not like the friendly riverbank at all.
No, it's dark, confusing, full of unseen threats, the weasels, the stoats. He gets completely lost and terrified.
And Rat has to rescue him.
Ratty comes looking for him, finds him huddled and scared, and guides him through the snow. And where do they end up?
Badger's home.
Exactly. They stumble upon Badger's door, and he takes him into his vast, ancient underground set. It's this image of deep-rooted safety, of finding refuge with a figure of wisdom and authority when the outside world proves too much.
It really highlights that theme of community and friendship providing safety nets.
And it shows Mole learning his limits, learning the value of friendship and guidance. But it also brings us back to that tension we talked about.
Between the individual and the community.
Yeah. Toad's all about individual desire, his ego, his freedom to do whatever he wants. But the consequences affect everyone. Badger's intervention, locking Toad up, even Mole needing rescue. It all suggests that actually communal responsibility and loyalty are vital. Friends have a duty to step in sometimes.
There have to be boundaries.
Right. But Graham, he doesn't just give us plot, plot, plot. He weaves in these incredibly beautiful, almost standalone chapters, moments of pause.
The lyrical interludes, they're quite unique, especially in what was ostensibly a children's book.
They really are. They deepen the emotional and, dare I say, spiritual side of the story.
Like Dulce Domum. Home, sweet home.
Oh, that chapter is so moving. Mole and Rat are heading home after an adventure. It's wintry, cold.
And Molly suddenly smells something.
He catches the scent of his old home, the little burrow he abandoned so eagerly back in the spring. And he's just overcome with longing, with homesickness. He breaks down.
And Rat gets it, doesn't he? He doesn't just hurry Molly along.
No, his empathy is immediate. He understands instantly. They find the neglected burrow, help Mole tidy it up, even decorate it a bit for Christmas. They spend the night there.
It's such a beautiful moment of friendship and a reminder that embracing the new doesn't mean you have to completely reject the old, your roots.
Precisely. Your past self, your origins still matter. They're part of who you are.
And then there's the other really famous interlude, maybe the most mysterious chapter in the book.
The Piper at the Gates of Dawn. It's extraordinary.
What happens there?
Mole and Rat are out on the river at night,
mm-hmm.
searching for Portly, the baby otter who's gone missing.
Okay.
And they start to hear this music, ethereal, haunting, beautiful music, mm-hmm. drawing them towards a particular island.
Like the siren song?
But benevolent. They reach the island just as dawn is breaking, and there they have this vision. They see the demigod Pan, surrounded by animals, holding his pipes, the protector of the wild.
Wow. That's quite a shift in tone, almost pagan.
It is, deeply mystical. They find Portly asleep safely at Pan's feet, and there's this sense of awe of touching something ancient and sacred in nature. Rat even whispers something like,
"This is the place of my song dream, the place the music played to me."
Yes, that's it. It suggests there's a deeper magic, a deeper reality accessible through nature if you just listen quietly, which is, again, the opposite of Toad's noisy motor cars.
But even Rat, the epitome of contentment, faces his own crisis, doesn't he? It's not all smooth sailing for him.
No, and that's crucial. In the chapter Wayfarers All, he meets a sea rat, a traveler who tells him these amazing stories of adventure, of ports, of the sea.
And Rat is tempted.
He's utterly captivated. It awakens this powerful wanderlust in him, this urge to leave the riverbank to see the world. He gets so swept up in it.
That mole has to physically stop him.
Yes. Mole has to literally hold him back, talk him down, remind him of everything he loves about his home, his friends, the river.
Why do that? Why show the perfectly content rat having this moment of intense dissatisfaction?
I think Graham is showing that contentment isn't just a passive state. It's a choice you have to keep making. The lure of something else, something more exciting, is always there, even for someone like Ratty.
So loyalty and reminding each other of what truly matters is key.
Absolutely. Friendship anchors you. But okay, we need to get back to Toad. He escapes prison.
In disguise, famously.
Yes. As a washerwoman, it leads to this series of quite funny, but also deeply humiliating adventures for him. He's constantly being tricked, having to rely on others, experiencing life from the bottom for a change.
Does it actually humble him?
Slowly, yes. The arrogance gets chipped away. He finally makes his way back towards Toad Hall, maybe still feeling a bit proud of his clever escape.
Only to find.
Disaster. While he's been away, indulging his ego, the consequences have arrived. The wild wooders, the weasels, stoats, ferrets have moved in. They've taken over Toad Hall.
So the chaos he ignored has literally invaded his home.
It's the ultimate price for his irresponsibility. His grand house, the symbol of his status, is overrun by anarchy. It's his lowest point.
But this time he can't just run away or boast his way out.
No. For perhaps the first time, he has to rely entirely on his friends. And they step up.
This leads to the big climax, right? The return of Ulysses.
Yes. What a title. Badger, the strategist, reveals he knows a secret tunnel into Toad Hall.
Of course he does. Ancient wisdom saving the day.
Exactly. So the four friends, Badger leading, Rat and Mole armed, and even Toad, surprisingly fierce when defending his home launch. This surprise attack during a banquet the Chief Weasel is holding.
A proper battle.
A short, sharp, decisive battle. They drive the Wild Wooders out, reclaim Toad Hall. Order is restored.
And Toad... is he changed by all this? Really changed?
Well, the ending suggests he is, at least for now. He hosts a victory banquet. But instead of boasting about his cleverness or his bravery...
he's quiet, modest.
Remarkably so.
Mm-hmm.
He gives a speech praising his friends, acknowledges his past foolishness with quiet dignity. He seems to have genuinely learned something about responsibility, about gratitude, about the value of his friends. His redemption arc feels complete.
So looking back at the whole story, what are the big takeaways? What themes really stand out?
Well, redemption is clearly a big one, thanks to Toad, but also that strong sense of pastoral idealism. Graham is definitely championing the simple, natural life of the riverbank over the noise and chaos of modernity, symbolized by the motor car.
And underpinning everything,
yeah.
Friendship.
Absolutely. Unconditional loyalty, friends sticking by each other, even when one of them is being utterly infuriating, like Toad. They risk danger, they offer support, they provide that safe place to return to. That feels like the core message.
It's a book that offers, I think, a deep sense of comfort, like returning to a safe harbor yourself when you read it.
Mm-hmm. It's a literary sanctuary, isn't it? It teaches these quiet lessons about being content, about valuing community, about humility, without ever feeling preachy. It just is. So here's something to maybe leave our listeners thinking about. The book seems to suggest that the really profound experiences, the almost sacred moments like the Piper at the Gates of Dawn, come not from chasing grand adventures like Toad, right? Not from noise and speed, but from quiet attention, from really being present in the natural world, like Ratty messing about in his boat. So the question is, How much does our modern world, with its constant push for more, for faster, for the next thing, actually stop us from finding that kind of simple, deep contentment that Rad embodies? Mandatory closing line. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.